to the next level.
So do you think and, a good minister, a good web minister,
like a lead minister, what I do, and what like Rick does, or what Randy does, do you think they should also call themselves a counselor?
Should call, I think you should call yourself a counselor if you have training in that. You mean biblically or professionally?
That's probably the shaky ground you get on legally, maybe.
Yeah, I think we should be careful how we use the word counselor. We do. I mean, obviously you do counseling, yes? Yeah, counselors, there's a lot. All right, we're going to get started. We're already 10 minutes late. Thank you. All right, come on in. Relax. Now, class. Thank you. Y'all in? Y'all, well, actually, my students are much better behaved than this group here as far as talking on average. All right, so we're going to talk about God and science. And let's just get into it here. Okay, now I've done a presentation like this a number of times. I'm going to kind of add and adapt it a bit. But what I want to do is talk a little bit about the background to Western science. And we could go back to the whole idea of chaos versus cosmos. And, where did science come from? And even atheists will acknowledge, at least historically, where science came from. Yeah. Science came from Christianity. And it's not just an accident that science came from Christianity, because there were a group of philosophers, Roger Bacon being one of them, and I'll mention also William Ockham and others, who, during the late Middle Ages, before the Renaissance, it became acceptable after many hundreds of years of not to inquire into the nature of epistemology and how we know things. And Roger Bacon came to the conclusion that the world, first of all, there is a God, all right, a single God who's a God of order, a God of love, all right, and decided that if that's true, then the world should contain order. The world should have this, it should be unchanging as God is unchanging. It should be ordered as God is ordered. In fact, his proposal was to study nature. We need to use external experience, aided by instruments, made precise by mathematics. And so the philosophy arose is that since there is a God of order, the world should be ordered. And ancient peoples didn't think this way. You know, for example, let's imagine some ancient people and they see a solar eclipse. What are they thinking is the cause of that? Why did that happen? All right. We had some taboo. We broke the taboo. The sun god is not going to come back. But the whole idea that the universe works according to predictable laws that don't change, where did that idea come from? It came from monotheism. But not just any kind of monotheism, a monotheism that includes the idea of God reaching out to us, God wanting us to know Him. So these early philosophers of science started with the idea that the world is ordered, that the world is noble. Remember, Doug talked about that a little bit, that there's essentially a one-to-one correspondence between how the world actually works and how our brain perceives things. Anyway, so Roger Bacon believed that essentially since God created nature, then we should be able to study nature and even discover things about God. Not that it could contradict Scripture. So anyway, the bottom line is science came by a group of people who accepted that there is order, that there's an unchanging order, and that order is knowable. And Roger Bacon added one thing to that. This was brand new, also made precise by mathematics. He believed, and he took a leap of faith, essentially, that not only is nature unchanging and orderly, but it should actually follow the laws of mathematics. Why should nature follow mathematically precise laws? Because of his concept of God. But it was quite an inspired guess, because it turns out nature does follow incredibly precise, symmetric, mathematical laws. So, and again, where did that come from? It came from his notion of God, which I believe is a correct notion of God. William Vaucom, in asking the question, how do we know things? He was an empiricist, as was John Locke, was mentioned earlier, and David Hume even. Yeah. What is true? What is known? How do we know something is true? What is known per se, evident by experience, or proved by authority of Scripture? So some things are just true. For example, 2 plus 2 is 4, and we can't conceive of anything other than 2 plus 2 being 4. And if you have an equilateral triangle, then the angles are also equal. Some things are just true, and because those are true, then other things follow from that. That's kind of the Greek idea of deductive reasoning.
Yeah.
Now, the Greeks weren't particularly strong in inductive reasoning, but basically evident by experience. And so basically, in order to understand how nature works, he thought we should look at nature. All right, and so scientists were heading in the direction to the idea that the Bible is not necessarily where you go to discover how nature works. If you want to discover how nature works, you look at nature and study her. And is proved by authority of Scripture. And it's not that he was bald, it's that he was a monk, as was Roger Bacon. In fact, Roger Bacon, interesting, he was fairly wealthy, and he spent all his money on instruments to do scientific experiments. He ran out of money, so he became a monk, a Franciscan monk, so he could continue his studies. Nikolai Copernicus, also very devout. He was Polish, but he studied in Italy. He became a canon of the church, studied church law, astronomy, etc. And he's the originator, at least in the modern world, of the idea of heliocentrism. And, you know, it was sure comforting to have the earth at the middle and everything going around the earth. And if you think about it, it sort of makes sense, since we are the center of everything. From the point of view of the monotheist, then it sort of makes sense that the earth is the center of everything. Seemed logical. But then you could convince yourself that that's what the Bible taught. And after the 1200s with Thomas Aquinas, the philosophy and the teaching of Aristotle became incorporated into Roman Catholicism, so that Aristotle and Catholicism had a marriage, which was perhaps an unholy marriage, but it was quite a marriage. And so Copernicus said, no, actually, we're not at the center of the world. In fact, the earth moves. And that took away people's security. I mean, we move? All right, and so suddenly, we were the most important thing, right at the center of everything. Now we're not at the center of everything. Actually, the sun is at the center. We're moving around the sun. But that didn't take away all the security. And then Bruno, around 1600, said not only that, but the sun moves through space. And the stars are at vast and varying different distances. Oh, my goodness gracious. So then we're a tiny, tiny little speck. So it's natural for people with a religious perspective to start to feel like, wow, our importance is being attacked by what science is discovering. And I don't agree with that, but I do agree that's a natural way to think about what's happening. So Nikolai Copernicus says we're not at the center of everything. Okay, the next person I'm going to mention here. Oops, that's right, I pointed the computer, not the projector. Galileo. One of my favorite philosophers and scientists, in his letter to the Duchess Christina in 1614, he said, the Bible is written to tell us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go. So that's one of those nice pithy sayings. I'm sure he said it in Latin, certainly not in English. But that's something to bear in mind. The Bible is not a science book. It's not intended to be a science book. Now, the Bible does occasionally make statements, which are objective statements, which might a scientist might have something to comment about that. But the Bible's not a science book. And so he argued, if you want to understand how the heavens go, look at the heavens. And it created a problem with the Catholic Church. He was brought before the Roman Curia. They wanted to outlaw people looking through telescopes. And he, as Galileo said, you're going to have to outlaw the whole science of astronomy. And he said, since God reveals himself in Scripture and in his creation, when we're studying creation, we're studying God, why do you have a problem with that? So this is, he's not the last of a long line of some sort of, you know, arguments that have occurred between believers and their particular interpretation of certain passages. And after all, the Bible does say that the sun rises, doesn't it?
It does.
How many of you believe that the sun rises?
Absolutely.
All right, no, don't put your hand, keep your hand. The sun does not rise. It's the earth that's spinning around, okay? So when the Bible talks about the sun rising, it, you know, clearly that implies that the Bible says that the sun moves across the sky and the earth doesn't move.
Poor interpretation of the Greek.
Right, well, there you go. But the point is not necessarily Greek interpretation. The point is trying to use the Bible to speak in areas that it most likely wasn't intended to speak in. Isaac Newton, one of the greatest minds in history, and he was a deist, and he was the one who discovered, you know the thing with Newton, you know, aha, apple, gravity, that's not exactly the aha. The aha with the apple was this: the reason the apple falls to the earth is the reason the moon goes around the earth. So he discovered the idea that the laws of nature on the earth are the laws in the heavens as well. Before that, the Greeks, as far as I know, all ancient thinkers had the idea that the heavens are somehow different than the earth. But Newton said, no, the heavens are just this, the same thing. It's all just one big thing. So if I add, I don't know, hydrogen and oxygen on the earth and mix them and light a spark, it would make water. And if you did that somewhere out there in the heavens, it would do the same thing. So he developed the idea of the mechanical universe. And now he became a deist. And it's interesting, he also is buried in Westminster Abbey, by the way, which... The atheist and the deist are both buried there. In fact, they had an act of parliament allowing him to be a member of the House of Lords because he was a deist. But nevertheless, the idea of the mechanical universe. And now again, you know, people who are thinking of, you know, the earth being in the center of the universe, it's almost like God wound up a clock and left it kind of going on its own. Yeah.
So before he was, so you're saying he became a deist?
I don't think he was born a deist. I don't know if you can be born one.
I mean, was like he a Christian before he was a deist? Or?
I'm sure he was raised to believe in Christianity. The thing is, in order to be a don there at Cambridge, you had to essentially be a member of the clergy, essentially. And he certainly was not going to be that. All right? But anyway, so we're heading towards, we're moving, but it's interesting, the movement that came out of Christianity is delving into some information, like the fact that the universe works according to mechanical laws that seem to act on their own. It's almost as if you could take God out of it, and why do you even need to invoke God anymore? So you can see why certain believers would start to be a little bit nervous about what science is producing. In my opinion, all along, they need not have been nervous about that, but you can see why they might have been. David Hume was the ultimate skeptic. And he did say one thing I think that's worth stating here. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof, which is why he rejected the resurrection. I think the proof of the resurrection is actually extraordinary, but we didn't have time for that presentation. Alright, here's one of my favorites, is Simon Laplace, who was extending the work of Newton and Laplace's equations, and he argued further for the mechanical universe, and he argued in his great treatise that he gave a copy to Napoleon, and he argued that through deterministic, materialistic laws, we could project all the way into the past, all the way into the future, in principle, and explain everything. And here we're entering, you know, what could start to become like the idea of scientism, which is it's just atoms bumping into each other, and that's all that there is. Anyway, Napoleon challenged him on not mentioning God in his description of everything, and he said, "I have no need of that hypothesis." So you can see where skepticism and atheism did develop, sort of indirectly anyway, out of the findings of science. And God keeps, you know, the earth gets smaller and smaller and smaller, humans become less and less important because the laws here are the same as the laws everywhere. No difference between here, the heavens, what are the heavens? So that's, by the way, we're going to get to the encouraging stuff, but there's a sense in which this is sort of discouraging. And then the idea of the age of the earth, because again, already thanks to Copernicus and Galileo and Newton, we're really, really small, but at least, you know, time-wise we're big, relatively. And then James Hutton, who came up with the idea of uniformitarianism, deep geologic time. All right, and when in his book he said, he approached the idea of the age of the earth, and he said his quote was, "No vestige of a beginning and no concept of an end." So the idea that the universe has existed forever. And again, not only are we small in space, we're immensely small in time as well. So apparently we're not very important.
Did you say no constant divinity?
He said no vestige of a beginning. In other words, the earth, he's talking about the earth itself. The earth, the processes that affect the earth have been going on for so long. Like before James Hutton, if you'd ask somebody, how'd that mountain get there? They would have said, well, God put it there. Or maybe it was thrown up there by the flood. And he's saying just natural processes. So he's essentially applying the idea of the mechanical universe, essentially, to the mechanical earth. All right, and he influenced Charles Lyell, who wrote Elements of Geology, and Charles Darwin had a copy, that was his Bible, if you will, when he went on the HMS Beagle on that trip. He took a copy of Lyell's Principles of Geology, which was thoroughly uniformitarian, which says, gradual processes, massive periods of time, history of the earth. Now again, if you take a certain particular interpretation, for example, of Genesis 1, you might see how that would be disturbing. What's interesting is the reaction of religious groups in America in the 1800s was rather mute. Okay, most religious groups of whatever denomination you want to mention pretty much accepted the idea of the old earth without much fight. It wasn't until the 20th century in America, specifically within the Seventh-day Adventist movement, if you want to know the history of it, where this counter-reaction against the idea of the old earth kind of came up. And of course, even the counter-reaction to the idea of evolution. Evolution was accepted during the 1800s, surprisingly, with rather little fight from religious groups. It's in the 20th century that this whole thing came up. All right? Let me see. And then there's, of course, Charles Darwin. My picture has him a bit older than the one that you saw before. Quote from Origin of Species, "It's mere rubbish to think at this point of the origin of life. One might as well think of the origin of matter." So what we've seen here is, it seems, from the visible concept, we keep getting smaller and smaller and smaller and less important. But actually, in the 20th century, through discoveries of science, it's starting to look like we're actually more and more important. In fact, we're actually at the center of everything. And that's the anthropic principle. I want to talk about the anthropic principle. The anthropic principle is the only working principle I've discovered so far that answers the question that scientists tend to not be very good at answering, which is, why? Science is fairly good at answering what, where, when, and to some extent even how, but science does a really poor job of answering why. In other words, we discover these laws, but why are they what they are? Why is it that we have however many elements, and why is it that we have gravity, and there's four forces, why not six forces, why not two forces? That's a good question. And human beings are more interested in why than in what and where and when and how. And so, basically, the anthropic principle says this: why? So that we could be here. That's why. Why is the universe as large as it is? Why has it been around as long as it has been? Why do the elements have the properties they have, etc.? So we're going to spend some time looking at that, thinking about that. Okay, Thomas Huxley, who gives the case, and he was known as Darwin's bulldog. He was the uncle or second uncle or something like that of Julian Huxley, who wrote 1984. Okay.
Orwell.
Orwell, I'm sorry. He wrote...
you're thinking of Aldous
Huxley. Aldous Huxley. He wrote...
Brave New World.
Yeah, Brave New World. Okay, good. We are as much the product of blind forces. Now, I'm going to claim that this is an item of faith. And this is an item of religion. That this is a religious statement. And it's accepted as truth, as if it doesn't even need to be investigated. This is a religious statement that requires an unfathomable amount of faith. Yet it is the statement of naturalism or scientism. We are as much the product of blind forces as the falling of the stone to the earth, the ebb and flow of the tides. We have just happened. Man was made flesh by a series of singularly beneficial accidents. The mechanical universe. Deism. Or agnosticism. In fact, Thomas Huxley invented the word agnosticism. He actually invented that word. Okay? Richard Dawkins, a more modern version. This is not in the God Delusion. This is, I can't remember, River Out of Eden. Says, in the universe of blind forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt and other people are going to get lucky. You won't find any rhyme or reason to it, nor any justice. And here's somebody who's being honest about all this sort of stuff. Not many are. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at the bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good. Nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. Huh. That's a rather dark and dismal philosophy, but this is the philosophy of scientific materialism. And it's certainly what's supposed to be the philosophy of all scientists. Of course, it's not. An interesting thing, they did a study, something like 1907 or 1908, somewhere in there, and they asked scientists in the academia, you know, how many of them believed in a creator. And it was something like 47%. And then they did the study 3 or 4 years ago, and it was 47%. It hadn't changed. It's interesting. So we're going to talk about the anthropic principle, which is not exactly the same thing as the design argument. The anthropic principle, I guess, is kind of related to that. So the Blind Watchmaker, of course, is a Dawkins book. William Paley came up with this argument, which is, you know, we're walking along the, I guess, the heather, or the whatever, or for us, I guess, down the beach, right? And you see this pocket watch sitting on the beach, and you think, well, how did that get there? What was the origin? What was the genesis of that pocket watch? Oh, I don't know. Some waves came in, they bounced each other, some rocks, and it got kicked over. Bird picked up the rock, it fell, and boom, there's that pocket watch. Okay? Anybody buy into that argument? All right, and like Dad said, Doug said, what about say an E. coli? What about a bacteria? Now, which has more evidence of design, the pocket watch or the E. coli?
E. coli.
The levels of sophistication is unimaginably greater in the E. coli. And what we're talking about is the simplest living thing. We're not talking about evolution here, we're talking about life itself. You have to understand, evolution is not a theory of origin of life. Mm-hmm. Right? It's a theory of life changing after it already existed. And if you go back to that quote from Darwin, he said, as to how life came about, you know, I can't even conceive of that. At least he was humble enough to admit that. Okay, so we're going to talk about that. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to be a science professor for a little while and talk about why as a scientist I'm convinced that there is a God. You know, I grew up going to church and I was Episcopalian, president of the church youth group, but I didn't believe in God. I don't know how that worked, you know, president of the church youth group, but I guess it didn't really matter. It wasn't that big a deal. That's where I got turned on to drugs, was going to my church youth group. One of the church counselors kind of... you know, got me high there after the meeting. But anyway, but when I went off to college, it was when I started studying science. It's like, oh my God. I mean, literally, oh my God. There is design. And Anthony Flew, it took him 80-something years. Yeah. For me, it was a bit earlier than that. So I'm just going to share a few things. Water, for example, the properties of water. Water is an incredibly, beautifully, wonderfully designed molecule. And life can't exist without some sort of a solvent. You try to make a living thing out of something solid, that's hard to really fathom. Or gaseous, you know, Arthur C. Clarke has these gaseous, that's kind of a silly there. So you have to have a liquid. And it turns out water has literally dozens of properties that no other substance has. And every single one of those dozens of properties is absolutely essential. Without that, there'd be no life anywhere in the universe. Yeah. And and I'm going to give you some examples, and we could say it just happened to have all those properties by accident. Or we could say that it's evidence that there was some purpose, some plan, if you will. Water's bent. It's bent at about 105 degrees. If water was straight instead of bent, it would boil at around minus 160, minus 170 degrees centigrade. So what about us? You know, and you think, well, why not just have life at that temperature? Because, see, if life is at that temperature, you can't have life. Because at that temperature, molecules do not have sufficient reactivity to maintain anything like a metabolism. There's actually a fairly narrow range. This is not theory, necessarily. There's a fairly narrow range of temperature within which the molecules that exist in the universe that we're part of anyway can be sufficiently reactive in order to maintain any kind of what we might even conceive of as life. Above a certain temperature, molecules fall apart. Below a certain temperature, there's no reactions. And the temperature range is somewhere between maybe minus 20 centigrade and about 70 or 80 degrees centigrade, maybe slightly higher. And it just so happens that water is liquid across that range. There are very, very few substances that are liquid in that range. Very few. Now, water, you see, it's sticky. And by the way, I hope you didn't need the label on top of the slide there. This probably would have done it for you, but that's just in case. All right, water is sticky. And in fact, water is very sticky. In fact, it's the stickiest of all molecules. There's many things that it's the most sticky of all molecules.
I'm sorry, it's sticky because it makes three bonds?
It's this thing called hydrogen bonding. I don't want to go into the details, but the one end is plus, the other one's minus, and because hydrogen is light because of quantum mechanical tunneling, you sure you want to know about hydrogen bonding in detail? All right, but the bottom line is the stickiness of water is key. If water was not sticky, there'd be no life. Water is the most amazing solvent. In fact, to conceive of life for advanced life forms where you have signals going from one place to another place, I don't know, what other besides electrical signal, I don't know what other kind of signal there could be, then that solvent has to dissolve ions. Guess how many liquids there are at room temperature that dissolve ions?
One.
One only. All right. Also, water absorbs heat by far better than any other substance in the universe. Why is that important? Well, that's another property essential to life on the Earth. Now, if water did not absorb heat as it does, the temperature of the Earth would fluctuate up and down by a couple hundred degrees centigrade in any given year, which would be certainly destructive to us, that's for sure. Could bacteria live on a world where the temperature would fluctuate as it would if water had this kind of heat-absorbing ability as other molecules? I don't know. Another thing about water, and we could go on and on and on about water, but water has this really odd property, which is that the solid floats on the liquid. There are actually two substances. There are millions and millions of substances. Two of them have this property. The other one's bismuth. Elemental bismuth. Not a very good proposal to support life as a fluid since it's a solid up to I don't know how many hundreds of degrees. But in the case of water, the solid floats on the liquid. Right? Ice floats on water. But why is that important? Because
the bottom dwellers.
Because when it's cold. For example, did you know? I used to live in Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, people can walk on water. They can. In the winter, they can. But anyway, so what happens is when it's cold, the colder ice floats on top of the warmer water. And it creates essentially a heat shield. Water is a very poor conductor of electricity. By the way, the fact that water is a good conductor, the fact that water is a good conductor of heat is very important in supporting life. The fact that solid water, we call it ice, is a poor conductor is essential to life as well. And water has this other really weird property. If you were to graph density versus temperature, makes sense, as it goes down. Every substance in the universe has density going down with temperature, and guess what? The only exception is
water.
It has this little bloop like that, and it's between 4 degrees and 0 degrees. And what happens is, in the winter, the warmer water goes to the bottom, and the cooler water goes up against the ice. Now you're thinking, so what if all the fish died in the lake? What about the oceans freezing to the bottom? Because during periods of relatively low solar activity, the oceans would have frozen to the bottom, all life would have disappeared. I could talk about the viscosity of water, etc., etc., etc. It's sort of like talk about design. Okay, and then there's this one here. Okay. Now, in chemistry, I teach that this was this chart was created by Mendeleev. That's not actually true. This chart was created by God. And the number of elements, and it keeps going up. That's why Anthony Flew kind of reacted to the whole... It's sort of like the evidence keeps piling up. The list of constants that could only be, you know, that are incredibly fine-tuned keeps getting longer every year, and we keep discovering more examples in the periodic chart. There are several elements that have a property that no other element has. And if that element didn't have that property, we wouldn't be here. There's so many of that.
Isn't that the definition of an element, though?
No. What do you mean?
It's got to be unique in some way if it's an element.
The definition of an element is based on the number of protons. So carbon is carbon because it has 12 protons. And in fact, actually, chemistry is more about the similarities than the difference between the elements. For example, as Casey, my former chemistry student, would tell you, all these elements in this column are actually quite similar in their properties. Their importance is more because of their similarities than their differences. Okay? Now, I'm going to focus in on one element, which is carbon. And when I teach organic chemistry, the very first thing I do is spend the first 2 days in that class discussing all the properties that are unique to carbon that no other element has. It just so happens that every single one of those properties that are unique to carbon that no other has are required for there to be life. Now, carbon forms four bonds, all right? You know, zero, this is the standard exercise in my chemistry class, zero bonds, one, two, three, four bonds. Actually, carbon's not the only element that forms four bonds, so does silicon. The problem with silicon is if you have a molecule with more than one silicon atom combined, they're explosive and they're completely unstable. And why is that important? Well, in order for a molecule to be three-dimensional, this is a basic rule of geometry. It's as true as 2 plus 2 is 4. In order for a molecule to be three-dimensional, you have to have four attachments to the central atom. All right? And if you don't have molecules that are three-dimensional, you can't have life that's three-dimensional. That doesn't make any sense. So, if I were trying to invent, of course, why three dimensions, why not four? Actually, there are four, whatever. I mean, all this is an amazing conception to me. But the fact is, the element that's the central element for life had to have four bonds. Carbon does. And carbon is the only element that you could form long chains. In other words, if you try to make a molecule out of nitrogen atoms, or sulfur atoms, or any other element besides carbon, any other elements besides carbon, you can't make large molecules. So to me, it's interesting. It's almost like God's fingerprints are all over here. Here's the large molecule, three-dimensional molecule building unit, all right, etc. Now, other examples, iron. Iron's got one property that no other element has. It has the property of being able to hold a magnetic field, a significant magnetic field. You think, well, so? Well, read this month's National Geographic article. And it talks about the high-energy particles that come from the sun. Now, I'm glad that we have this thing in the universe. I'm glad it's not here, though, because that would be really a problem. I'm glad there's a place in the universe where energy is created in great magnitude, okay? But I'm also glad I don't live there. Now, this massive energy-producing thing, that this well-designed thing, talk about designing hydrogen to fuse, to form energy, this well-designed thing, it gives off all kinds of energy that are not so healthy, such as solar, wind, the high-energy protons, and protons and electrons. Anyway, luckily God made one element, exactly one though, not two, not seven, one, which creates the magnetic field, which deflects all those high-energy particles away from the Earth. Actually, you know, there are two kinds of energy that the sun gives off which are absolutely deadly to all life. The other one is ultraviolet energy. And it's interesting because God made an element, which is the only one. He made an element which also has the property to absorb that ultraviolet radiation, which is oxygen. Oxygen. In fact, you could teach an entire course on all the unique properties that water has that are essential to life. You could do the same thing with oxygen. You could do just a one-semester course on all the properties that make oxygen unique from all other elements. And I don't know, in every case, all of them are required for life. I'm sure most of them would be. OK, Okay, uranium, that's one of my favorites, uranium. Now, we used to think of uranium as kind of dangerous stuff, and it is. But luckily for us, it's dangerous. If uranium were not dangerous, none of us would be here. Because uranium is radioactive, yes. And the Earth is, according to scientists, the Earth is around 4.5 billion years old. Whether it's really that old or not, I can't settle that question. I don't know. I'm an agnostic on that. But scientific evidence leans that way. Just so happens that uranium has a half-life of the same, 4.5 billion years. Why is that important? Well, because if the Earth didn't have uranium, then the Earth would be cold all the way through. If the Earth were cold all the way through, which would happen in about 25 million years after the Earth was created, formed by the way, then the Earth would be completely sterile. Maybe bacteria could be maintained on an Earth without plate tectonics in the long run. And besides, the Earth would have no atmosphere. So like I said in the prior talk, if you want to live on a planet without plate tectonics, without uranium, there is very, very little uranium in the crust or in Mars. Virtually no uranium on Mars, which is kind of problematic for life existing on Mars. Right. Which, by the way, is essential not only for plate tectonics to recycle the minerals, it's also essential for creating the atmosphere, it's also essential for the magnetic field as well. All those things.
Mainly in the core versus the crust, or is it equally distributed?
The magnetism is created in the heart of the Earth.
There's the uranium.
Right. It's also important for iron to be quite dense. And by the way, iron is the most stable of all elements, which is also essential. If iron were not the most... I'm going on to the stuff I don't normally mention. I could go on and on and on and on and on and on and on about all the properties that each individual element has, and only one element has that property, and it's uniquely adapted so that we could exist. All right, I'm going to go on to the next idea, though. Again, if you go back, it just happened. Man was made flesh, and he's purposely sort of abusing John 1 there when he says that. And man was made flesh by a singular series of beneficial acts. And I say, boy, real beneficial. Okay, DNA molecule, that's kind of, to geeks like me, that's like, that kind of makes the hair stand up on the back of your head. I mean, DNA is so amazing. What an incredible design. What a gorgeous, fantastic design. It is. And see, DNA contains a code. Now, I could forgive Thomas Huxley, to some extent, for proposing his crazy idea, because in the 1870s and 80s, it wasn't quite so wacko as it is now. Come on now, a code? And by the way, it's a code to create proteins, all right? So the C's and the A's, they're not literally letters. It's not like if you had a microscope, you see that, oh, there's an A there. That's cool. It's nitrogens and carbons, and it's a symbol to represent it. But each of the three nucleotides makes a codon, which codes information for an amino acid that in building a protein. So that's the whole genetic information. But it's a code. And somebody's going to propose that this code just sort of happened. Yeah, random event creates a code? That's insane. That's irrational. And here's the deal. The purpose, this thing is a code to make these guys proteins, okay? Proteins do most of the work. The DNA contains the information, and the protein does the work. Now, the design of DNA is really beautiful in this. There's two grooves, the narrow groove and the wide groove. The wide groove is where the proteins fit. In fact, protein molecules, a string of proteins, is an absolute perfect fit for that groove. I mean, it fits, you know, like a hand in a glove kind of thing. And why is that important? Because, see, the protein tells the DNA what to do, and then the DNA makes the protein that tells the DNA what to do. Now, this person who believes that life came about by a random accident has to believe that not only did the DNA, which contains all this information, I'll give you some numbers there, not only did the DNA get created by accident, but the protein that makes the DNA, but also that was made by the DNA, would also have to be randomly created by accident at the same time. All right, now if that went over like this, I mean, I could say it again, and it may work, it may not work, but I want you to conceive of the levels of impossibility we're talking about here. In other words, the only way protein is made in the universe is by DNA. The only way DNA is made in the universe is by protein. But not only that, but this accidentally created DNA had to be the DNA that makes the protein that made the DNA that made the protein. You see what I'm saying?
Chicken or the egg.
Right, exactly. The whole chicken or egg argument. And it just sort of happened. Just kind of boop, into existence. How much information? How much information?
So it goes contrary to the whole theory that over time, over billions of years, random acts will eventually lead to...
Right. Random acts, random events can create order. They can. Science has revealed that order does come about naturally. And these scientific materialists want to say, see? But what is not created naturally is information. Order can be created spontaneously by nature. Crystals and things like that. But information is not. And that's the problem with DNA. It contains information. The human genome is around 3 to 4 billion pieces of information. Alright. Okay. Come on now. There we go. Let's think about life. This thing that accidentally happened. Never mind the creation of humans. Once life exists, how life would change over time, that's another story. Okay. Simplest life form would contain about 500 billion atoms. This is an E. coli. Okay. So maybe the simplest life, maybe 200 billion atoms. That might be enough. The amount of information, we're talking 10 to the 12th pieces of information in this thing that just happened to accidentally come about. Alright, 3,000 or 4,000 different protein molecules in E. coli, DNA and RNA to make those. The amount of information to build a human being is around 4 billion base pairs. The simplest bacteria is around 100 million. Let's just say 50 million. Well, that's the amount of letters in roughly 10 to 15 novels. So the chances of all these letters coming together in the correct order to make a living thing be kind of like taking 50 million letters, throwing them in the air, and then when they land on the ground, it would write out 15 novels that you could read and would make sense. All right, that's the point is, nature does not make information. It might make order, but it doesn't make information. And so this idea, to me, it borders on ludicrous. Okay.
Throw those numbers up in the air 50 billion times, it would never be.
No, if you try to calculate, because people occasionally, here's the probability of this happening, and let's not try. I mean, there's more atoms in the universe. One over all the atoms in the universe is much, much bigger than the probability of this happening, and that's just one thing. We're not talking about, but what about water having the right properties and all those other things. You see, it becomes overwhelming at a certain point. So anyway, the simplest life form, you'd have to have the proteins, the DNA, the lipid, and all this other stuff that you don't want me to talk about, okay? You get the idea. Okay, so that's a little bit of chemistry and biology. What about physics? Of course, physicists were unanimous in this. The universe had existed forever. Now, why did they say that? Was it because they'd done an experiment to show the universe had existed forever? Why is it that almost all physicists believed before the 50s that the universe had existed forever? The reason is because the philosophical implications. In other words, it had to exist forever because the alternative is it was created. And so this belief was never a scientific belief. It was always a philosophical statement, a statement of faith. And it's as good as any other, though. I mean, it hasn't or it has. Anyway. And then, of course, in 1929, Hubble discovered the universe is rapidly expanding and developed the idea of the universe having, because it's expanding, you extrapolate back, it was small. Developed the idea in the 40s of what we now call the Big Bang. And you have to understand, in the 1940s, it's not like physicists, astronomers, and cosmologists said, oh, right, thank you for helping us out there. No, they fought tooth and nail against the Big Bang Theory for a long time. It was a bitter fight, despite the evidence. But the Big Bang Theory resulted in production of some models, and one model said there should exist radiation that fills the universe. It even predicted roughly the temperature of that energy that should fill the universe. Then Penzias and Wilson, a couple of, they're not cosmologists, they were actually doing experiments with microwave radars, trying to do some microwave experiments, and they got a bunch of static in their radar equipment. You know, they actually thought that maybe a pigeon had left some guano in their radar, couldn't get rid of it. And then one of them was talking at a party or whatever to a friend of theirs who was a cosmologist, and we got this problem with this background microwave radiation, we can't get rid of it. He's there, oh my God, and again, it's oh my God. I mean, yeah, we just discovered the background, the remnant radiation from the Big Bang. So by the 60s, dragged, kicking and screaming, physicists reached the conclusion that had been in Genesis the whole time, which is the universe was created out of nothing. And if the Big Bang theorists are right, I'm not saying the Big Bang happened, I don't really know if it happened. How can anybody know if it happened? The evidence is quite strong to support the idea that that's the best explanation of what we can observe. But if Big Bang theorists are right, there was nothing. No time, no space, no energy, no nothing. And then there's a brilliant flash of light. And from there came everything. Sounds familiar. I think I read about that. In Hebrews 11 it says, by faith we understand that what is seen was made from what is unseen. And for us, it's not even based on faith anymore. It's based not on faith also, but on scientific evidence. So finally, the physicists came around to that. Now, the next slide, here's where we're getting really to the kind of stuff that really bothered Flew and others. Now, that's a small number.
Yep.
Now, if that was your probability of winning the lottery, would you play the lottery?
Absolutely not.
Okay. Now, I don't play the lottery at all, but that's because I figure if people want to pay voluntary taxes, that's okay with me. I just don't want to be involved in that. Anyway, what was noticed by cosmologists and space at his name again. The guy who's just barely can talk. Stephen Hawking. Thank you, Stephen Hawking. All right. Stephen Hawking. And by the way, interesting personality there. We're not going to get into it, but interesting personality there. Yeah, and husband-wife relationship. And but anyway, Stephen Hawking and others in modeling the Big Bang, they realized that the structure of the universe is such that there's this fine balance between expansion and contraction. Expansion based on the energy in the initial event, if you will, and contraction because of gravity. And what they found is, if you make the size of the force of gravity bigger than it is by this much, as a proportion, then the universe would have gone shoop, and then like that. If you make it smaller than it is, by proportion this much, it would have expanded forever. It would have never contracted to form planets or galaxies. Now, as a scientist, you know, we have dials, and we dial things in, we want to get the right setting there. I'll tell you right now, we don't have dials that are that fine. Maybe we can have a dial, you have special dials that have all these different things. Maybe we can get 5 orders of magnitude. Maybe even 6 or 7 orders of magnitude on a dial. But how about 115 orders of magnitude on that one?
You need to go to this.
Okay? So, no wonder people started to think about the entropic principle. But here's the thing is, every year, more and more and more of these things come out. It's sort of like every time you look, you find another thing about the universe. Now, don't try to read this slide. That's not the point. And actually, at last check, it was around 38 or 40 or something like that. And these are facts, undisputable facts about the universe, which undisputably are fine-tuned so that, you know, in a way that if you change them, we would not be here. The nuclear strong force, that's what holds the nucleus together. If the nuclear strong force were a tiny bit stronger, all right, there'd be no hydrogen. In which case, there'd also be no stars, and therefore no fusion and no life, obviously. Turns out if it was a tiny bit weaker, there'd be only hydrogen and no larger elements. And it's just the little tiny, a couple numbers past the decimal. Oh, there you go. We got it locked in there. That's true with the electric force and all these other forces. In fact, it's beginning to look, as you look around, it's almost like every single fact that defines how the universe works is like this. Yeah?
Do you have some website?
Sure. Sure. All right, and it's in this CD. And I'm recording myself right now so we can make actually a better version. because that one was recorded in somebody's living room. So, anyway, there we go. So now on the CD, it'll talk about making the new CD. That'll be interesting. All right. Anyway, conclusion. Since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, eternal powers, and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. And those who understand science, as we delve further and further into science, we're like, oh my God, again, oh my God. And so I say scientists have the least possible excuse for not believing in God.
Yeah.
But you know, surely none of us have worshipped created things. But that's what, you know, scientific materialism is. It's worshiping the created thing rather than the creator. Now let me move on. I want to talk about science in the Bible a bit. Now here we have to be a little bit careful, because I already said the Bible is not a science book. And I think certain passages in the Bible have been taken to prove, you know, from science that the Bible is inspired by God. And some of those, I think we need to sort of treat it the way a reasonable skeptic would treat it. You have to be a little bit careful. Yeah. Anyway, here's the quote I read earlier from Dallas McCown. He talked about the philosophical insupportability of Christianity. But now we're talking about it being unsupportable. In other words, it's a common thing. Well, everybody knows, obviously, the Bible's full of blatant fables and myths. And if anybody wouldn't believe the Bible, it's clearly going to be the scientist, correct? What do we establish by the first part of this talk? What we established is there is a God, that God is very, very powerful and very, very, very smart and very big and exists outside of time and space. But which God? You know, which God? So why not Brahman? Why not Allah? Or why not nothingness, as the ineffable nothingness of Buddhism? Or, you know, why the God of Christianity? And anyway, the Bible's been attacked, obviously, more than any other, and scrutinized more than any other book. But I want to make the claim that scientists, in reading the Bible, ought to be extremely impressed with the knowledge. Even though the Bible's not a science book per se, there are things in the Bible which are amazing, especially related to medical knowledge. Now, here's one of the pages of the Papyrus Ebers. All right, it's on papyrus. That's why they call it the Papyrus Ebers. This was sort of like the PDR of ancient Egypt, physician's desk reference. And scholars would say that of the great ancient cultures, probably the Egyptians had the most advanced medical knowledge. They did even brain surgery and you know, dentistry and that kind of stuff. And this document comes from about 1500 BC, which is fairly important in terms of timing, because this is roughly the world that Moses came from. This is the world that the law of Leviticus came from. And let's look at some of the prescriptions in the Papyrus Ebers. Okay.
What year was this, I'm sorry?
About 1500 BC. Okay, here we go. To prevent hair from turning gray. Okay, I guess maybe I need this more than anybody else in the room here. To prevent hair from turning gray, anoint it with the blood of a calf, which has been boiled in oil, or with the fat of a rattlesnake, or a mixture of six fats, mainly those of the horse, the hippopotamus, the crocodile, the cat, the snake, and the ibex, to prevent hair loss.
Rogaine.
Yeah, I like to joke about this one. You know, presumably the men were using this to attract the women, right? So if you're smearing this stuff, you know, the cat oil and the snake oil, I don't know if that's going to attract the women. It's kind of funny, but you know what? It's actually not all that funny if you think about it, because this is what people had to do with diseases. Some of the other prescriptions, some of the other medications included lizard's blood, swine's teeth, putrid meat, that's really good stuff. You know, you got an infection or something like that, take some meat, leave it out there until it turns putrid and kind of smear it around on there. That's really help out. Pig's ear moisture, there you go. Excrement. Human excrement as medicine. And again, The purpose of this is not to shame those stupid Egyptians. The purpose of this is to point out that I guarantee you that the Bible would have stuff like this in it, because there's a lot of medical advice in the Bible. A lot, actually. If you think about it, quite a bit. And the Bible would have to have this kind of stuff in it if it was written according to human wisdom. Because this was the medical knowledge specifically in Egypt at the time that the Levitical code was put together. Okay, now in Exodus 15:26, God says to His people, if you follow these laws, I'm not going to bring on you any of the diseases of your neighbors. And the Jews seem to have a way of bouncing back, you know? The Jews seem to have a way of kind of, you know, they're a lot of Jews. I believe one of the reasons for that is when they obeyed the laws given to them by God at Sinai, they lived longer, they produced more children, they were healthier. All right, and we're going to see about that. And what's curious about this is, in every case, these laws that God gave them, they had a spiritual significance. And at the same time, they had a medical wisdom behind them. How God could kind of put all that together. In fact, they had a spiritual significance, they had a foreshadowing significance, and a health significance. All three. God, of course, as you're aware, said certain meat you can and you can't eat. Pig, trichinosis, there's something like 22 different diseases, deadly diseases that are carried by pork. All right, now the pork in the markets, raised under relatively safe conditions, is relatively safe, but even then, I typically want to cook my pork all the way through. Okay? Steak tartare. Jan and I were in Venezuela last summer, and we got served, you know, said just whatever. So I'm in this restaurant, and all of a sudden, a plate full of raw beef. Okay, raw beef. And of course I ate it, because the fact is that beef is relatively safe to eat even raw. In fact, almost every kind of meat that's on the don't eat list is relatively dangerous. And almost every kind of meat that's on the you can eat list is relatively safe. For example, eating raw shellfish, good idea?
No.
Eating raw fish, good idea?
Sure.
Yep. And the Bible says fish with scales, yes. Shellfish, no. Now, there's a couple of possibilities here. You could argue for accident, or you could argue for inspiration, and I'm just trying to think of any other alternatives here. I guess maybe the Jews were doing blinded studies. They were, you know, trying different, you know, I don't think so. Scientific method had not been devised. Now, you could argue for accident or luck if it was just this one particular, but as we go down the list, there's a pattern that's going to emerge here, that when they followed the laws that were given them, they had a tremendous advantage in terms of health. And so when God said, if you follow my law, I'm not going to bring on you any of the diseases of your neighbors, He was being quite literal about that. Okay, another example. This is a Jewish medical aid. This is not back during the time of Moses. This is later on, something like 100 AD. But just in case, maybe the Jews had some inherent, I don't know, they're all doctors or some kind of statement like that. I shouldn't even say that. But this is a Jewish medical writing here. Here we go. The gnat, feeble creature, taking in food but never secreting it. Let's stop there. The claim here is that flies don't excrete. Is that true?
No.
That's not true. And like I said to the gathering of scientific colleagues in that van a couple years ago, I said, I've read the Old Testament through many times, and I haven't found any science errors, and I read it pretty skeptically. All right. Anyway, taking in food but never secreting it is a specific against the poison of the viper. So I guess they must have kept dried flies in jars in case you got bitten by a snake, and then they'd kind of smear that around. And I don't really think it did a whole lot. So again, the Jews were not coming up with this stuff on their own. Whoever touches the dead body of anyone will be unclean for 7 days. This is cool, because this law has foreshadowing implications about Jesus. It has spiritual implications for the Jews, and it also saved them from many, many deaths, I guarantee you. The idea that if you touch a dead body, you're unclean. You're to be separated. You're to be to separate from other people. You purify yourself with the water from the red heifer sacrifice, actually. The ash from the red heifer sacrifice and water with some hyssop. Dip it in the water. Sprinkle the ten furnishings and the people who were there. It seems a bit cruel that the people who've really sacrificed and taken care of the body at the funeral, the family members, that they should be, you know, ostracized for 7 days. You know, typical of the Old Testament God, this mean, angry God who's just trying to find things to, you know, make them not do and that kind of stuff. Well, actually, Semmelweis, Ignaz Semmelweis, a doctor in Vienna, who was influenced by Lister and by Louis Pasteur that Doug mentioned earlier. He was working in a hospital, as a woman's hospital. The death rate in the hospital for the women was about 18%. 1 in 6, roughly, were dying. And so women, the reason people didn't have their babies in the hospital wasn't because they couldn't afford to go to the hospital. It's because they couldn't afford to have the doctor come to their home. So the poor people gave birth in hospitals. Anyway, the practice, the common practice in the hospital where Ignaz Semmelweis worked was that the physicians would do autopsies from the deaths the night before, poking around, and then they'd go upstairs onto the ward and start going from there. And you can imagine it was called puerperal fever. It was a bacterial infection, but this is back when they didn't know about infectious diseases. Well, they knew diseases were infectious, but they had no concept of what was causing it. So Semmelweis says, after you touch a dead body, you're unclean. Wash your hands with soap and water. The death rate went down to about 2%, and he reasoned that perhaps the infection could travel from patient to patient. The Bible also says when women give birth, they're unclean for 7 days. It's a good idea to me. When is a woman most likely to get a deadly infection? During her period or immediately after giving birth? So again, he said, between every patient, you wash your hands with soap and water. The death rate went down to 0.5%. Of course, the doctor was saying the women were dying because of hysteria. This is a hysterical woman. That's why they're dying. Typical male thing. It's so embarrassing sometimes to be a man. We've done so many stupid things. Anyway, it actually fell to about 0.5%. Anyway, you would think the doctor would say, oh, Ignaz Semmelweis, you awesome stud of medical knowledge. They fired him. They refused to clean their hands after a while. The death rate went right back where it was, and he died of an infection not too long afterwards.
How long did they give that? How long did they give that?
I don't know, a few months, I believe, but I'm not sure.
A few months, and they weren't convinced.
Right. He published it. He published the work in journals. He published the data. Yes, he did. I've read, you know, the articles, not the originals, but I've read copies of the articles. Now, what God said was, take the ash from the red heifer sacrifice and water and hyssop. Now, hyssop is a plant that has a lot of oil in it. And it just so happens, if you take ash, that's what your great-grandma used to make soap. She took not oil of hyssop, she took oil of pig. She took oil of pig and ash from the fire and water. She made soap. But see, it just so happens if you use the oil of hyssop, you're adding about 10% of this compound thymol. When I teach organic chemistry, I teach about phenols. Phenols. The very first property of phenols, I tell all my students in organic chemistry, is that they're antiseptics. In other words, the most efficient at killing bacteria that's also not poisonous to animals is phenols. So the command of God upon touching a dead body was to wash yourself with a very powerful antibacterial soap. Okay, how did Moses get that one right? Alright, again, the idea of quarantine. Quarantine seems cruel. It's cruel, but the alternative is death, not just for that person, but for those around them. Leprosy is not particularly contagious. It's only slightly contagious, which is sort of bad and good. Leprosy was the most feared disease by many in the ancient world, not because it killed so many. More people died of yellow fever and malaria and pneumonia and plague. The reason Leviticus was so feared is because of the way it killed people. Let's get away from that slide here. I killed millions in Europe, around the world for thousands of years. Yeah?
It's a question. Was there leprosy in Israel then? I read recently that they didn't even come to the Holy Land until after the time of Christ. Hansen's disease, real bad.
I'm not sure. Alright, but they certainly had extremely debilitating diseases that were caused by infections, skin diseases. So, either way, I don't know. I'm not sure. Anyway, it turns out in Europe, there were some monks, I believe in the 1600s, who decided to actually try the biblical admonition, all right, to quarantine. And leprosy disappeared within just about 20 or 30 years in Europe, virtually disappeared. Okay, another example. It says in Leviticus 17:14, a rather cryptic comment, the life is in the blood. There's a lot there. When God said to his people, the life is in the blood, there's a lot of significance there. Now, medical science said the disease is in the blood. Right? That was the most common medical treatment throughout the 17, well into the 1800s. Right, bloodletting. And basically, medical science said this. Obviously, infection can go throughout the body. So obviously, therefore, it's the blood that spreads it through the body. Therefore, if you have a disease, the disease is in the blood. So you take out the blood to solve the problem of the disease. The Bible said the life is in the blood. Now, what does that mean? Was that a medical statement? I don't know. I don't think it was principally a medical statement. All right, but it is true the life is in the blood, and we know that because that's where the immune system works. So people probably should not have been taking their blood out. Probably a bad idea. Here's the barber pole, and that's because the surgeons would not do the bloodletting. The surgeons sent the patients to the barber because the barber had all those sharp instruments. The barber did the little thing there. In fact, here are some of the instruments they used to use. All right, these bloodletting instruments, it's not very well focused, but you get the general idea. The Bible said the life is in the blood. All right, here's another one, circumcision. Now, this is actually not in the Levitical law. This goes back to Abraham. It goes back to Abraham. God told him, for generations to come, every male amongst you who is 8 days old must be circumcised. All right, and I was listening to a debate about 3 days ago, and he says, yeah, God's in favor of genital mutilation. All right, well, how about this? You heard these statistics. Back then, people lived only to an average of about 20 or 25 years. That's true. And it's not that the human lifespan was shorter. In fact, a significant number of people would live well into their 70s or 80s. The reason lifespan was so short is because of infectious diseases. Mainly bacteria, also viruses, and certain fungi and whatever. And where does fungus and bacteria prefer to grow? All right?
Showers,
right.
Warm, moist
places. Dark, wet, warm places. And where on the human male body is the darkest, wettest, and warmest? The brain. Thank you. But the interesting thing is, I have to finish up in a couple of minutes here, so let me get through this sort of quickly here. Is why the eighth day? Why the eighth day? Think about it. If he'd said the third day, makes sense. The third day, the seventh day, the whole symbolism there. What's the symbolism of the eighth day? I don't know. Why the eighth day? Well, it just so happens that we don't produce vitamin K. Vitamin K is produced in your large intestine by the bacteria, and there. Thank God for bacteria. Thank you very much for bacteria. Anyway, but when you're born, you don't have vitamin K. You don't because vitamin K does not pass through the umbilical cord from mom to baby. And also, in order for blood to clot, you need this stuff called prothrombin, which is the blood clotting protein. And vitamin K helps to make that. So you have prothrombin when you're born, but because you don't have vitamin K, it drops down to very, very dangerous levels, which is why to circumcise a child on the first day, the third day, not a good idea. Then what happens is the bacteria that get into the gut start producing vitamin K. Prothrombin goes up. In fact, prothrombin goes up to an unnaturally high level, And then it drops back down to the equilibrium level. And this is scientific data on average available prothrombin versus time in a baby. And do you notice something there? How did Abraham decide the eighth day? I say because God told him. That's what I'd say.
He didn't look at the prothrombin chart?
No. In fact, he also didn't...
It was a foreshadowing.
There we go. He also didn't do this. This is a joke here, all right? He also didn't do this. I don't think so. A scientific experiment. So, you know, so when I think about science and God, they kind of work together on that whole thing. I'd say that. But that, what about science and the Bible? I'd say we need to be a little bit cautious. But because sometimes we could take something that's in the Bible that may not really be a scientific statement per se, but in terms of the medical knowledge, it's really striking. In fact, this whole idea that the Bible's full of blatant, stupid, ridiculous, you know, ignorant scientific statements is simply not true. Quite the contrary. Okay, so we could talk about some of the cosmology of the Bible. There, I think we get in a little bit of trouble because trying to find cosmology in the book of Job is probably pushing things just a little bit, but just so happens that it does say that, which was first discovered by Anaxagoras in the Greeks, okay, as opposed to the mythological idea. Alright, let me see here. This thing is no longer working. And we could have Buddhist cosmology, which doesn't work with science at all. You can't possibly reconcile Buddhist cosmology. And there's a little chart. I was in a Buddhist temple in Thailand last January. All right, I think that's good enough. We get the idea. Do we have time for some question and answer, Doug? When's our next thing? I'll take a couple.
What was that other Job passage? 26:8. What was the
other
one?
Sorry. I don't know.
You.
Yeah,
one of the sutras.
Job 26. Yeah. Let's see if I can get back to it there. Oops.
Sorry.
That's at my website. No problem. So, any other questions? Yeah.
I'm just curious about the science because you're talking 30 zeros and a one. How did they even figure this stuff out?
It's actually not that hard. To model something like that is actually pretty simple. I mean, you know, I could take a proton and an electron, and I could shoot them in opposite direction, and I could calculate the speed with which they could escape each other, escape velocity. And I just need to know the size of the force. So that may sound like astounding to you, but it's a very simple calculation. Very simple calculation. Harder to calculate is you have to conceive of the amount of energy in the initial expansion. But in order to fit the data we have, it comes down to a very, very fine tuning. Yeah?
Atheists claim that life just happened over enough time.
Right.
Has anyone done any modeling, computer modeling, to determine how much time it might take to come up with the billions and billions of bits of data in the DNA code?
First of all, I don't think they're going to try because they know secretly ahead of time what happens with time. You know, I, as an organic chemist, I know what happens with time. Entropy takes over. So these people just say, well, obviously it happened. I mean, how do we know it happened? Because obviously it did, because it's the only possible explanation. It had to have happened. So the creation of information over time, they use terminology like chemical evolution. Now, biological evolution makes sense. Chemical evolution is ludicrous.
Can you say that again?
But you need...
They have to talk about this idea that molecules have a kind of pre-intelligence. That molecules can naturally select for more and more complicated molecules. This is crazy. No experiments support any of this stuff. None.
So
it's pure speculation.
They haven't done any kind of...
Well, they've done stuff. For example, they'll do, you know, the famous Urey Miller experiment. They took hydrogen, methane, water, and ammonia, mixed it, put a spark there, discovered what I could have told you easily as an organic chemist. You mix those heat, you'll get small molecules. All right, but the thing is, will you get a chain of thousands and thousands of molecules which contain information that could actually do something? And the answer is no, not ever. Time does not help that. Time makes it go in the opposite direction. Always, without exception.
So these molecules fall apart.
Right. You don't create more and more complicated molecules over time. That violates the second law of thermodynamics.
Yeah, that's why I'm so amazed that people even... I mean, I'm practically science illiterate. And I know the second law, I know entropy, and I say, well, does it make any sense? How could you...
Right, it doesn't make sense that the Mormons believe that Jesus came to America and preached to the Indians, and with these masses, why do they believe that stuff? So why do people, the basis, you have to understand the underlying assumption here.
Yeah.
And a lot of scientists aren't really aware of what they're assuming.
Yeah.
So if you start with an assumption and then you argue from there and you have circular reasoning, you come back to where you started. If you're not willing to question your foundational underlying assumption, then, funny things happen, amazing things happen. So it's not because it's necessarily a reasonable assumption, it's because if you talk to these people, they say, well, obviously this, we all know that. It's just a matter of figuring out how it happened. Okay? So, yeah.
You were talking about uranium earlier.
Yeah.
Is most of that in the core? Or in the...
Yeah, the reason it's in the core, luckily for us, is that it's so dense. Isn't that convenient?
Is that where most of it is?
Of course, because it's dense. Yeah. That's why the iron's in the middle. There is some uranium towards the crust, not much. There's some, because it does get mixed. Yeah.
It's funny, you'd think there might be a centrifugal effect. So the heavy stuff would go to
that. Well, Earth doesn't spin anywhere near. If that were true, then we'd be thrown off the Earth too. Yeah. If the centrifugal force, if the Earth was spinning fast enough, we'd be whipped off the Earth. And you're right, that would force the uranium up. But then again, the Earth would have never formed in the first place. If the Earth was spinning that fast, it would have never even formed at all by gravity. So clearly gravity favors moving towards the middle. That's well established, I think. So heavy things go down. All right, so don't be intimidated by tall, bald, geeky-looking people with glasses. Yeah.
The example that you put up there, the 115 zeros followed by one,
yeah,
which is the ratio between gravity. Is it between gravity and the electromagnetic force?
No.
Between just the force.
The amount of energy itself.
Of energy.
By the way, you say, well, how do they come up with these numbers? You have to understand the people who came up with these numbers are philosophically absolutely opposed to the conclusion. So this is not a bunch of wild-eyed, whatever Christians sort of doing their research. Just like the people who discovered the Big Bang were philosophically disposed in the exact opposite direction. And the discovery of these things are philosophic. The discoverers are, not all of them, but the majority of them are philosophically strongly predisposed in the opposite direction. The nice little quote from Stephen Hawking is, this clearly has theological implications. And I say to Stephen Hawking, well, then why don't you accept them?
Didn't Josh McDowell used to be an atheist?
Yeah.
Yeah. So did I. And, Yeah. So, we have a 5-minute break? 10-minute break?
Yeah, we can say 10.
10? Great.
Prose Rombren, does that... The 8 days, I mean, it follows in the...
That's right.
The 8 days for circumcision. That just follows the seven Mormons and clean after the birth of the child, correct? I mean, to me, it's like...
Because the woman was not... The law of women being unclean was not in existence in that time.
Moses, right.
Or maybe it was, we just don't know it.
Okay, because to me, it seems... Yeah, I know it wasn't written down until at least Levitical law of Moses, but the idea of the woman being unclean for 7 days, and then after that, she goes and presents herself at the temple along with the baby, makes sense that's why it was
right.
Days.
All right. You're right.
As opposed to.
I had never thought of that.
The other question I had about that though is, all right, let's say that we didn't have that. Let's say that the Bible said, you know what, just whenever you get around to it, as soon as you can. So first day, second day, third day, there were. How many more deaths would we have on a fasting day?
The answer is, if you wait after the eighth day, hardly any.
But before the eighth day?
There would be a significant number.
It would be.
Yeah.
Okay, so it is.
But after the eighth day, there's virtually no problem with waiting after the eighth day.
Okay, so
because the increased amount of clotting after the time is not significant.
Okay. I mean, yeah, I think it's quite a coincidence, to say the least, that the eighth day is when our profound run hits that 125%, and I think it's great apologetic.
Right.
But
the question is, did God have in mind the eighth day because after 7 days and then the eighth day, and then he made the prothrombin on the eighth day? Or was it, he made the prothrombin on the eighth day, and then he made the 7 days of the Sabbath, so
right.
I have...
But the other side of this, though, is what I wasn't sure is, could the atheists throw up, yeah, but so what? What are we talking about? Like, you know, one death in 100,000 or something? I mean, you know, it's not as strong if,
right.
if it's not a significant number of lives saved.
Right. And I think it's the total of all these kinds of information that creates an argument. I'd agree that...
Oh, yeah, it's the big picture that...
Right. The eighth day is not a... If that was all we had, we'd have not much.
Right.
I'd agree with that.
Do we... I'm surprised that no one's doing this modeling for... that our creation scientists that we hate so much aren't modeling via computer so they can get out this information that, hey, you know, this is absolutely ridiculous. There's no possibility of the time. I mean, I watched a special lately on the... just on the history of the Earth, and apparently according to this, the last ice age, the last time the continents were all together that blocked the flow and caused an ice age and killed pretty much everything, was really just a few hundred thousand years ago.
Uh-huh.
So you almost have to have life springing up from that point, not from you don't have 4 billion years, which isn't really that long,
uh-huh.
but you really have only a few hundred thousand years at the most.
Oh, life was not wiped out during that ice age.
Okay. According to them, everything except for a few bacteria, a few...
No. That's not true.
Okay.
That's not even close to true. I mean, there are areas of the tropics which remain warm even during the strongest ice age.
What they were saying was that because the continents all came together and blocked the flow...
We're talking about hundreds of millions of years ago.
Okay, we're that far back.
Yeah.
Okay. But still, you're only...
There's some evidence for some really, really massive ice ages.
Right.
Way.
But still, you don't have 4 billion years for life. Now you only have a few hundred million then?
Well, the fossil evidence says that there's a Cambrian explosion around 550 million years ago.
That is what killed the dinosaurs, right?
No. That's when basically complex animals popped into existence.
Oh, okay.
And then around 250 million years ago, there was a massive die-off.
Right.
Roughly 95% of species disappeared.
All right, so that was when the dinosaurs...
But that was not just down to... That was another die-off. Dinosaurs is 65 million years ago.
Okay.
That was a smaller die-off. It's hard to pin down the numbers. Around 75 or 80% of all species. But, that's 25...
And there's the one around 200.
Right, 250. Yeah, 250. And...
isn't there one between?
There are several. There have been several, but ones that had an effect of wiping out whole categories of kinds of animals tends to be the two, the 240 and 65. But there's some evidence for other massive die-offs, a number of them.
Doesn't the geological and fossil record give us life just really, really quickly after the Earth cooled enough to even allow it?
Right, fairly quickly.
Fairly complex?
Well, no. Ridiculously simple life for 3 billion years.
Okay.
And then suddenly, around 500 million years ago. So, The evidence is very, very, very simple life for about 3 billion years.
All right. So we have about 1.5 billion years of fairly complex life.
No, about 550 million.
Well, 550 million years
yes.
is what we have. Oh, right, because it took 1 billion years or so to cool off the Earth.
Well, oh, good. The Earth cooled off to the point of having a crust in a fairly short time. To measure the time from when the Earth had a crust to life appeared, there's no number for that. Because we don't have rocks that old. They've all been kind of... The oldest rocks are around 3.9 billion. The oldest evidence of life is around 3.5 billion. So was there life between 3.9 and 3.5? The jury's out on that.
But still.
But the Earth was around for quite a while before the oldest rock that we have that's actually still here. There's been turnover.
2 minutes and we need to get going.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
A lot of the properties of water really come up in mechanical engineering.
As just came up with a reason, thanks to Jason, for why the eighth day. I have to think about that. The reason for the eighth day is that it's the day after
the
day of purification for the woman.
Well, of course, some of those properties came up, obviously, to us, like polymer. Who do you say is bent? Maybe the atomic change.
The angle, as opposed to 180 degree angle.
Yeah.
We're aiming to wrap up this class in an hour and then have our competition.
Yes.
And this class is right in the middle. The only way we're going to do it is if we start now. I will take no responsibility for going over time if I'm delayed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You guys are ready, we will begin.
All right.
This last class is on archaeology, and it's got two parts, Old Testament and New Testament. We'll take a break in between. Fortunately, we've already covered a lot of this. John's covered a lot of this. And so if you see me speeding up, I'll tell you, you know, we did this yesterday. Introductory matters, we talked about this a little bit. The Bible is not like a story that took place in some unspecified land in some unspecified time. Once upon a time, long, long ago, in this time, there was a very good king and a very bad